This is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, it was on this very day in which year that Marian Anderson became the first African-American to sing at New York's Metropolitan Opera? Was that A, 1930, B, 1943, C, 1955, D, 1968, or E, 1979? So just how long ago was it that this historical desegregation event occurred? And question number two, it was on this very day back in 1998 that a well-known singer died in a skiing accident. Who was this singer? Hint, he was also the mayor of Palm Springs, California, and had been married to the singer Cher. So, who was this singer? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of January the 5th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1924, that George Gershwin completed Rhapsody in Blue at the age of 26. And it was 1 year ago today, back in 2017, that the final episode of the final season of American Idol aired. And in country music news, we have this review of Chris Stapleton's new album, From a Room, Volume 2. It's given 4 out of a possible 4 stars, and this review is published in The Week magazine, December the 15th, 2017. It's no mystery why so many country fans have embraced Chris Stapleton's music, said Julie Height in NPR.org. There's no clutter to it, nothing to hide behind, nothing competing with the furnace blast force of Stapleton's belting. The 39-year-old singer's reliance on a small band and his resistance to beat-driven pop country showcase his songwriting gifts. And on this second 9-track release this year, the Kentucky native again plays an appealingly tortured soul, one who sabotages all that's good in his life. But here he's also singing about meaningful relationships and the focus on others lends greater emotional weight to his entire body of work. Stapleton has also found a way to better mix traditional country with Southern soul, said Walter Tunis of the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader. That plays out brilliantly on the last 4 tracks, starting with A Simple Song, a whispery parable of faith. For the finale, he imbues pop staples friendship with a rural rustic R&B charm that recalls the band. And in classical music news, we have this article written by Priscilla Frank, published in HuffingtonPost.com on the 3rd of November, 2016, entitled, Here's Why Teaching Children About Classical Music is Worthwhile. I played some pieces of 20th, 21st century music for kids. Reddit user Johan Yellowdog professed to an Imgur thread on Monday. I asked them to pick their favorite piece and draw a picture. If you've ever felt a panic listening to contemporary classical music, realizing you have absolutely no idea what is happening, you can surely sympathize with the group of seven-year-olds that was subjective to the music of Joby Talbot, John Adams, or Shostakovich, and forced to express their responses immediately after. But, of course, many seven-year-olds have not yet acquired debilitating feelings of self-doubt, anxiety, and embarrassment that hinder so many a grown adult in their daily lives. And so, when asked to draw in response to some of the most powerful and emotive songs made in the past two centuries, they did so quite beautifully. The drawings, which are shown in the article, by the way, prove that no matter how much you learn as a grown-up, it's hard to compete with the fearless imagination of a little kid. These drawings will make you a believer in the universal power of music, the ubiquitous language of art, and the fearless chutzpah of people under 10 years old. The accompanying pictures, by the way, depict elements of the musical compositions like weightlessness and simplicity that more experienced minds might not readily detect. And in jazz and blues music news, we have this article published in Indie Week on the 20th of December 2017, written by Thomas Goldsmith, entitled All Roads Lead to Raleigh. Before finding a place in blues and folk history, Book's renowned guitarist Leadbelly made a short stop in the state capital. Before Johnny Cash recorded Rock Island Line, before Pete Seeger sang about studying war no more, and before Nirvana did a harrowing version of Where Did You Sleep Last Night on MTV Unplugged, there was Leadbelly, mentored by the Titanic blues man Blind Lemon Jefferson. Leadbelly was a singer-guitarist and storyteller, one whose work helped define these artists and American vernacular music in the 20th century. But before he was even Leadbelly, he was Huddy Leadbetter. Born in 1889 to an independent farming family near Moorings Point, Louisiana. In December 1934, Leadbetter rolled into Raleigh along with two famous music collectors. The trio spent 4 days just before Christmas in Raleigh gathering songs as part of a long-lasting effort to preserve and promote American music. An early inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Leadbelly stands today as an overarching figure of American music. He used his deep, rangy voice and powerful guitar playing to render blues, field hollers, country-style tunes, hymns, story songs, and later on songs of social protest. Although he may lack the mythological cachet of a Robert Johnson, Leadbelly produced a body of work at least as fundamental to roots music, and he came to Raleigh at the peak of his powers. Songs such as Midnight Special, Goodnight Irene, Cotton Fields, and Black Girl, Where Did You Sleep Last Night? And his propulsive performance style made Leadbetter a fixture of the New York and national folk scene. He befriended Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and enjoyed modest success as a record and radio artist. In 1934, Leadbetter was working as a driver for a father-son team of folklorists and song collectors, 67-year-old John A. Lomax and 19-year-old Alan Lomax. They were traveling the South with Leadbetter serving as a savvy intermediary during stops at prisons to record inmates' blues, ballads, field hollers, and gospel tunes. The Lomaxes had met Leadbetter while collecting songs in a Texas prison in 1933. In later documentary footage, Alan Lomax, who died in 2002, says that his father had the idea that all the sinful people were in jail. He noted that turning to prisons as sources yielded incredible pieces of vernacular music. When Johnson Lomax hired Ledbetter in fall 1934, the musician's role paved the way for the white collectors and their recording equipment in the southern towns they visited. In their 1992 biography of Leadbelly, The Life and Legend of Leadbelly, music scholars Charles Wolfe and Kip Lornell wrote that Ledbetter continued to prime the pump at prisons by playing and singing the kinds of songs that Lomax wanted, and stimulating the local singers to come forward. The article skips down. But why were they all in Raleigh? As far as can be determined, the travelers simply found the City of Oaks in their path, just as Chuck Berry did in Promised Land and James Brown did in Night Train. Even though the party spent much of their time lugging around a disc cutter and tracking down singers and storytellers, John Lomax often found time to get out in the communities they visited. John Lomax III, a journalist and producer in Nashville, Tennessee, describes what he knew of the era during an interview this month. They could visit prisons, and grandfather would lecture at various places, he says. He would talk about collecting and songs, and lots of times when he had Leadbelly with him, Leadbelly would sing. It's tantalizing to think of these famous men holding forth in 1934 at a college in Carolina's folk collecting scene, or at a Raleigh academic or social gathering. Huddy Ledbetter, born in 1889, came from a stable family, but had walked the rough and sometimes violent path before joining the Lomaxes, doing farm work and other hard labor as he traveled through the South and West. But he was also a brilliantly talented musician who must have practiced and played at great length to achieve his mastery of playing and singing. That wasn't anything unusual for blacks to leave home at an early age, because they were running away from that pressure and that hard labor they were under. Tiny Robinson, Ledbetter's niece, told me in 1990 in Brentwood, Tennessee, for Ledbetter and other black musicians on the road, the guitar was more than a musical instrument. It was company to them. The guitar was all they had. It was their life, Robinson said. The article skips down and ends with this. In the end, Leadbelly remains an artist worth listening to and discussing for people of any age, for anyone who cares about the musical history of the United States. He came from a different America, the one before radio and records tended to standardize music styles across the nation. Although he was a magnificent blues player, he wasn't limited to blues or any style, but ranged freely through, and sometimes merged, types of music associated with both black and white Americans. Although he left little mark on Raleigh at the time, Leadbelly went on to make an imprint on America's cultural consciousness that ought never to fade. And in music research and technology, we have this article published by Lauren Neergaard on the 19th of December 2017 for the Associated Press, titled Striking a Chord, NIH Taps the Brain to Find How Music Heals. Like a friendly Pied Piper, the violinist keeps up a toe-tapping beat as dancers weave through busy hospital hallways and into the chemotherapy unit, patients looking up in surprised delight. Upstairs, a cellist plays an Irish folk tune for a patient in intensive care. Music increasingly is becoming a part of patient care, although it's still pretty unusual to see roving performers captivating entire wards, like at MedStar, Georgetown University Hospital, one fall morning. It takes them away for just a few minutes to some other place where they don't have to think about what's going on, said cellist Martha Vance after playing for a patient isolated to avoid spreading infection. The challenge? Harnessing music to do more than comfort the sick. Now, moving beyond programs like Georgetown's, the National Institutes of Health is bringing together musicians, music therapists, and neuroscientists to tap into the brain circuitry and figure out how. The brain is able to compensate for other deficits sometimes by using music to communicate, said NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, a geneticist who also plays a mean guitar. To turn that ability into a successful therapy, it would be a really good thing to know which parts of the brain are still intact to be called into action. To know the circuits well enough to know the backup plan, Collins added. Scientists aren't starting from scratch. Learning to play an instrument, for example, sharpens how the brain processes sound and can improve children's reading and other school skills. Stroke survivors who can't speak sometimes can sing, and music therapy can help them retain and retrain brain pathways to communicate. Similarly, Parkinson's patients sometimes walk better to the right beat. But what's missing is rigorous science to better understand how either listening to or creating music might improve health in a range of other ways. Research into how the brain processes music that NIH is beginning to fund. The water is wide, I cannot cross over, well-known soprano Renee Fleming belted out, not from a concert stage, but from inside an MRI machine at the NIH campus. The opera star, who partnered with Collins to start the Sound Health Initiative, spent 2 hours in the scanner to help researchers tease out what brain activity is key for singing. How? Well, first Fleming spoke the lyrics, then she sang them, and finally, she imagined singing them. We're trying to understand the brain not just so we can address mental disorders or diseases or injuries, but also so we can understand what happens when a brain's working right and what happens when it's performing at really high level, said NIH researcher David Jangra, who shared the MRI data with the Associated Press. The article skips down. Brain cells communicate by firing messages to each other through junctions called synapses, cells that regularly connect, for example, when a musician practices, strengthen bonds into a circuitry that forms an efficient network for, in Fleming's case, singing. But that's a healthy brain. In North Carolina, a neuroscientist and a dance professor are starting an improvisational dance class for Alzheimer's to tell if music and movement enhance a diseased brain's neural networks. Well before memory loss becomes severe, Alzheimer's patients can experience apathy, depression, and gait and balance problems as the brain's synaptic connections begin to falter. The NIH-funded study at Wake Forest University will randomly assign such patients to the improvisation class to dance playfully without having to remember choreography or to other interventions. The article skips down. Unlike music therapy, which works one-on-one towards individual outcomes, the Arts and Humanities program at Georgetown Cancer Center lets musicians in residence play throughout the hospital. Palliative care nurses often seek Vance, the cellist, for patients anxious or in pain. She may watch monitors matching a tune's tempo to heart rate and then gradually slowing. Sometimes she plays for the dying, choosing a gently arrhythmic background and never a song that might be familiar. Julia Langley, who directs Georgetown's program, wants research into the type and dose of music for different health situations. If we can study the arts in the same way that science studies medication and other therapeutics, I think we will be doing so much good.
In my direction, so thankful for that, it's such a blessing, yeah. Turn every situation into heaven, yeah. Oh, you are
And in pop music news, we have this article written by Joe Coscarelli, New York Times, 28th December 2017, entitled, "The Pop Charts Were Crazy This Year, Here's Why." As streaming continues to remake the music industry, artists and record labels schemed and scrambled, remixed and bundled to get their songs into fans' ears. This year, 12 songs reached the top of the Billboard Singles Chart, known as the Hot 100. From Ed Sheeran's meticulously constructed Shape of You to Cardi B's casual Bodak Yellow, Money Moves. Including feature appearances, 14 acts had their first number ones, like the electronic dance veterans Daft Punk as guests on the Weeknd's Starboy, and the Philadelphia firecracker Lil Uzi Vert, whose verse on Bad and Bougie by Migos begins with Ya, yelp five straight times. The track with the longest run atop the heap, Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber, was sung almost entirely in Spanish. And this is Luis Fonsi, Daddy Yankee, and Justin Bieber performing Despacito in the background right now. On the album side, there were number ones by Future, with two different LPs in back-to-back weeks, the revitalized and bigger-than-ever LCD sound system, the little-known rapper NF, and of course heavyweights like Katy Perry, Pink, and Taylor Swift. In other words, the monoculture had so many disruptors that cultural whiplash became the new normal. The most obvious explanation was that the newfound dominance of digital streaming scrambled the entrenched hierarchies, elevating voices that had long puzzled or offended gatekeepers. With physical and digital album sales, as well as track downloads, all in freefall, and hip-hop and R&B setting the pace for streaming, major labels and major stars alike were often left scrambling to earn the honors that once came so easily. Because the rules and norms of this era are still coalescing, the systems could also be gamed and manipulated. Loyal listeners schemed to get their favorites recognized, while sly marketing efforts tried to put a heavy thumb on the scales. In all, the music industry and listener machinations made for one of the most disorienting and often exhilarating years of hit music in recent memory. And in local music news, we have this from the NC Symphony. Go to ncsymphony.org or phone 919-733-2750 for more information and tickets. Pictures at an exhibition, Friday and Saturday, January 12th and 13th, 2018 at 8 p.m., Rune Bergman, the conductor, Beethoven Symphony No. 4, and Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, The Great Gate of Kiev, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, is playing in the background right now. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question: it was on this very day in what year that Marian Anderson became the first African-American to sing at New York's Metropolitan Opera. Was that A, 1930, B, 1943, C, 1955, D, 1968, or E, 1979? So just how long ago was it that this historical desegregation event occurred? Correct answer, answer C. It was as recently as 1955 that the first African-American sang at the Metropolitan Opera. As noted in NPR.org, this groundbreaking performance was just one step in the broader acceptance of African-American performers in classical music. Just 20 days later, baritone Robert McFerrin, father of jazz singer Bobby McFerrin, followed Anderson as the first male African-American Met soloist. He appeared in Verdi's Aida. and on January 27, 1955. The country didn't change overnight, Driscoll says. There were still problems taking African Americans on tour for the Met throughout the 50s and the 60s. So, in other words, it's not as if everything became rosy in 1955. But seeing this as an important symbol, that this was the beginnings of the integration in the deepest sense of classical music, that's why it's important. And the answer to our second question, it was on this very day back in 1998 that a well-known singer died in a skiing accident. Who was this singer? And I gave as a hint, he's also the mayor of Palm Springs, California, and had been married to the singer Cher. Who was he? Correct answer, Sonny Bono. As noted by CNN on January the 6th, 1998, South Lake Tahoe, California. An autopsy on the body of U.S. Representative Sonny Bono, the former singer and TV performer who was killed in a skiing accident Monday, revealed that he died of head injuries. Bono's body was found late Monday afternoon in a narrow, wooded area between two ski runs at the Heavenly Ski Resort. Tree skiing is popular with many skiers, said Perini, and Bono's family characterized him as an advanced skier. It's common for skiers to go into that area and out of it. 2 years ago, Bono received a deep gash on his chin after he and another skier collided at the Big Bear Lake area east of Los Angeles. He ended up with 11 stitches. His death came less than a week after Michael Kennedy, the 39-year-old son of the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy, was killed in a similar accident in Aspen, Colorado. On Capitol Hill, Bono quickly established himself as a hard worker and a popular fundraiser for the Republican Party. Some right-wing conspiracy theorists have claimed that Bono was murdered and that his assassination was linked to President Clinton and his Attorney General Janet Reno. Sonny and Cher sang in 1967, The Beat Goes On. So let's close out today's music review program with some Sonny and Cher. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review, and as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me. Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.